Welcome to the podcast of Greenlight Bookstore. This is the quarantine season. While Greenlight isn't currently hosting in-person gatherings, we're still striving for ways to create connection around books. Thanks to the gracious efforts of authors and interviewers scattered across the country and the world, we've taken our events programming online, hosting live readings, conversations, and audience questions via Zoom. Our podcasts this season are a record of those intimate conversations between thinkers and creators speaking from separate rooms, and a window into the ways that ideas and stories connect us all. Once you've listened to the conversation, you can purchase the books mentioned in this podcast at Greenlight's two bookstore locations in Brooklyn or on our website at greenlightbookstore.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's live online author event with Greenlight Bookstore. I'm Katie from Greenlight, and we're thrilled to host tonight's event with Priyanka Champaneri, launching her new book, The City of Good Death. She will be talking with Grace Toulousen, so you're in for an excellent time. Before we start, I just want to say a huge thanks to Priyanka, Grace, and the team at Restless Books for making this happen, and to all of you for showing up. Though we're not able to host events in our store spaces, our community of authors and readers is still here. We're grateful for your support and for the chance to make space for conversation and connection. We are recording tonight's event, so look for video or audio versions on our social media channels later on. And importantly, tonight's featured book, The City of Good Death, is available for sale from Greenlight Bookstore. You can stop by in person in our bookstore locations, 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. every day of the week, and you can purchase Priyanka's book and many others on site. Or you can order online at greenlightbookstore.com for a quick pickup at the store or for shipping anywhere in the U.S. I'll be dropping the buy link in the chat in just a moment. If you care about supporting the careers of authors and the ongoing existence of independent bookstores, buying tonight's featured book is a great way to show your support. Our interviewer tonight is Grace Toulousen. Her first book, The Body Papers, is a New York Times Editor's Choice selection, winner of the Massachusetts Book Award for Nonfiction, and winner of the Restless Books Prize for New Immigrant Writing. She was born in the Philippines and raised in New England. She graduated from Tufts University and the MFA program in writing at UC Irvine. She was the recipient of a U.S. Fulbright Fellowship to the Philippines and an Artist Fellowship Award from the Massachusetts Cultural Council. She taught writing for many years at Tufts University and Grub Street. Currently, Toulousen is the Fannie Hurst Writer-in-Residence at Brandeis University. She will be speaking with our featured author, Priyanka Champaneri. She received her MFA in Creative Writing from George Mason University and has been a fellow at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts numerous times. She received the 2018 Restless Books Prize for New Immigrant Writing for The City of Good Death, her first novel. The City of Good Death brings us inside India's holy city of Benares, where the manager of a death hostel shepherds the dying who seek the release of a good death while his own past refuses to let him go. Priyanka is going to start us off with a reading from the book, and then she'll be talking with Grace and with all of you. Please take it away, Priyanka.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for coming and deciding to spend your evening with Grace and I. I'm super excited to be talking to Grace. If you happen to have the book, I'm going to be reading from page 133. This is a section that features the hostel assistant, Mohan. And he is super anxious and stressed in this section because there is a ghost in the hostel washroom. And he's been lying to the guests about what it is. And to deal with that stress, he has taken to eating a lot of random things at random times. And this has resulted in some interesting physical changes for him. One of the reasons I wanted to read this section is it's one of the few that remained intact from when I first started writing this book back in 2009. I also wanted to read it because it's my brother's favorite section. Anytime I would talk about revising the book or changing it, he would kind of check in to make sure I hadn't done anything to his favorite section. So I always listen to my elders, and this reading is for my bye. No amount of home remedies, however, could fix Moen's problem. He'd forgotten the basic principle that anyone past the childhood years of eating green mangoes could tell you. Changes in diet will lead to other inevitable changes. In the mornings, as the priests queued outside the washroom for their morning evacuations, Moen took his place behind them, but his need was false. Later, however, when the midnight hour bridged the old day and the new, his muscles tightened in urgent familiarity, and he faced his most distressing dilemma yet. He almost soiled himself thinking about the stories. Never go at night, never, the old farmer Ramu used to warn the circles of dusty children who gathered at his feet to hear his ongoing narration of the Mahabharat. Dhoti loose, he said, ass bare in the night, that's when they get you. They, of course, were the night spirits, ghosts, souls in limbo, just like the one in the washroom. Mullen shivered at the recollection. Anything could happen to a person who let his bowels loose in the night hours. You could be possessed or struck dumb, forced to walk backward while singing for the rest of your life, or simply disappear. And if you ventured out beyond the Bovin gates, to some narrow lane where the beggars ensconced themselves, or to the ghats that the sweepers used in the mornings, no, there was Rummu again, warning him. Once, the old man had said in between great bites of sugarcane, wrenching off the hard green peel with his five remaining teeth and spitting the shards a good 3 meters behind him, there was someone in the village. We called him Chico because he was always eating those fruits. He was a good fellow, but he got into trouble when he drank, and hey, that's another thing to stay away from. Well, one day he angered a sadhu who lived next to a nearby temple. This Chico took a piss right in the spot where the sadhu would sit for his meditation, and that was it. After that, nothing ever worked properly for Chico. Every time he sat down, he'd have to get up again to take a piss, and at night his stomach gave the worst rumblings and sent him racing from his house to the field. He tried everything. He begged the sadhu's forgiveness. He did puja at the temple. He walked for days to visit every doctor he could find. Nothing. Once the curse was there, no one could take it away, not even the sadhu himself. And then one day I heard that Chiku had disappeared. No one knew what had happened, but there were some boys traveling the road who stopped to sleep near a field, and they said they were woken in the night by a man who ran past them screaming, and from behind they could see his ash shining in the moonlight, covered with shit like a buffalo's. No one ever saw him again, but anyone could guess at what had happened. Ghosts like such things, nah? As the cramps and exertions of Moen's intestines accelerated, he let loose the rapid breaths of a woman in labor and thought with increasing panic of the unfortunate Chiku. His options were to risk going outside where ghosts could be, or go to the washroom where a ghost most certainly would be. The danger of possession, of being cursed or seized or at the very least frightened, was enough to make him pause, but he couldn't hesitate for long. Quietly, the assistant crept from the bhavan with his water-filled brass lota in hand, slipped into the haven of a wet, dark alley, and saying the great god's name as his stomach churned and sighed, did the thing. Thank you.
Yay. Thank you for that reading, Priyanka. Thank you again to Greenlight Books, and thank you to the team at Restless Books. I'm so excited to be here tonight and to be celebrating the City of Good Death. This is your first novel, and I'm just wondering, like, how has it been for you today? What is it like? Give us a snapshot of, launch day, and also please tell us about your sweater.
Okay. The day has been pretty good. I took the day off of work, so I got to sleep in a bit. Then my brother bought me a book cake, so it's a cake with my book cover on it. We got a lot of takeout from my favorite Thai place, Thai Basil in Chantilly, Virginia. I got to take a nap, so that was really nice. And now I get to talk to like one of my favorite people in the world, Grace. So I think it's been a pretty good day. And yeah, I'm wearing this sweater, which, I mean, let's just talk about how amazing it is and how amazing I am. So there we go.
So the sweater is something that you've knit. It's in like the with the color scheme of the book cover. I think it's not your only sweater that you've knit that's related to the book. I remember seeing one last year too.
Nerd alert, Grace, like gigantic, right. Just like have it flashing off of my forehead. Let's just do that.
And for people here tonight who are into knitting, there is like another, an upcoming event where they're like, it's more knitting focused, for sure. Okay, so both of us, won the same prize from Restless Books, the prize for new immigrant writing. And, you know, I've been, I love Restless Books and working with them. And I think this project that they have and this prize has been really important because there are people in publishing who've been traditionally underrepresented. So since we are talking about publishing stuff, tell us a little bit about your publishing story and why you entered the contest and have gone with Restless Books.
Yeah. After I finished a draft of the book that I thought was strong enough to finally start going out to agents, I started querying agents, and I am so insanely lucky to have found my agent, Leigh Feldman, who is just one of my favorite people in the world. And I say in the acknowledgments, I thank her for loving the book on first read and never stopping loving it, because that is absolutely true. She loved it immediately and her faith in it never wavered. We spent about 2 years sending it around, and it was basically sent, I believe, to every single tier of the publishing industry in the United States. So everything from the big five or big four, I guess, is it now, like whatever it is now, to like smaller houses, independent presses, all of that. And then also to some houses in the United Kingdom and in India. And we got back, I think, what was coined as like the nicest rejections that I think Lee had ever seen. They were so kindly written, and these folks had definitely read the book because they loved things about it. They loved the language, they loved the visuals. And a lot of them said some iteration of, well, let us know when Priyanka writes another book because we want to see that book. But for whatever reason, they just couldn't make the push to be able to buy this book. So it was an interesting experience in that sense, because you simultaneously feel validated and you feel rejected at the same time that, okay, so I guess something about this is working, but something about it is not. And it becomes this never-ending quest of, okay, well, what's wrong with it? Am I what's wrong with it? Is it like the whole book that's wrong? Is it the writing that's wrong? Is it the time? Is like the phase of the moon? Like what's happening here? Like what do we do here? Like to make it right, to make it doable. And again, Lee never lost faith in it ever. She never made me feel like the problem was me or the book or the writing, which was so critically important to have somebody like that in my life, outside of my family, outside of my mother telling me that. That, you know, it's not, you don't have to change anything about yourself or about your writing. This has nothing to do with you, almost. So what ended up happening after 2 years, the other great thing about Lee, and I'm talking her up and talking her up because I really, really do love her, is the fact that she sees me, I think, as a writer who, she's more invested in my career as a writer rather than just one single book. So we got to have the conversation about how maybe we needed to just shelve this book. And then I needed to start thinking about writing something else. So that, it like the way I've said it is a little cut and dry. For Grace, you know, there's like an intense grieving process that goes along with it, especially because this was a book, oh gosh, I don't even know how long anymore it took to write it, but I think it was at least like 6, 7, 8 years of my life where what I was doing was going to my full-time job and then working on the book. That was it. That was my life. And that's fine. You know, that's absolutely a choice that I made for myself. But then when you kind of come to the end of the road and it doesn't end up the way that you had kind of hoped, that's a blow that you have to kind of figure out how to absorb and then see your path forward. So I think I got to that point where I could see a path forward. It took a really, really long time. And I also wasn't sure, this sounds very, very dramatic, but I wasn't sure if I'd ever write again. Not because of that rejection, but because the ideas had stopped coming. And it was finally like another year or so before the ideas started coming back. And that's when I started realizing that my connection to writing had nothing to do with the validation that publication might offer me. It was going to be something that I was going to do no matter what, because that itch, that spark was coming, and whether I liked it or not, I was going to have to do something about it. In that time period, I ended up, I was on a creative writing listserv. So I saw an advertisement for the Restless Books Prize for New Immigrant Writing. And I saw that they were looking for novels for fiction that year, so a short story collection or novel. And then I saw that the judge, along with the publisher, Lon Stobbins, who is also amazing, was Taya Obrett. And I had read The Tiger's Wife. And so I knew Taya loved ghosts. She loved magical realism. She loved mythology and folklore and basically all of the things that I loved and that I hoped I had injected into my book. So I kind of thought to myself, having had experience with these things, like, you know, like when you submit to a contest, you need to have some sort of creative affinity with the person judging it. So I thought, well, I think I kind of tried to do that with this book. So I really love Tiger's Wife. Maybe she'll love this. I don't know. You know, like literally every single door had been closed in front of me. And I say it like that as if I expected something out of it, but I really didn't. I really saw that email as a ping to be like, you have a duty to do this book, which is you need to see it through to the end, even if that end goes nowhere. you have a duty to follow every single path and follow and knock on every single door. Because I needed to face myself in 10 years and tell that person that I had tried as much as I could. So I submitted and I forgot about it. And then I got an email over the summer that I was a finalist. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I guess I'll put that on my resume. Like, that could be a cool little thing, like finalist for this contest. Because I also, they had posted on their blog all of the other finalists and I read their book descriptions and I was like, well, there's no way I'm winning this because all of those books sound amazing and all of those books should be published. And I hope those people all ended up with publishing deals because they were incredible books. But yeah, I forgot about it. And then in the fall, I got another email, this time from Alon. And I'm a very superstitious person. And that email happened to come on a very inauspicious day on the Hindu lunar calendar. So I didn't open it. I just let the whole day go by and I didn't open it. And then the next day was a lucky day. So I woke up in the morning and I opened it and it said I had won.
There's so many things that I want to follow up on with what you said. I mean, the last thing that you said, it's almost like you're making your own luck. Like you're superstitious. I am definitely superstitious too, but there's this way that like, you know, you decided like you were gonna, there's stuff that you can control and stuff you can't, but you could control like opening it tomorrow as opposed to today. Yeah. On a luckier day.
Yeah.
So that's great. And also this notion about like caring, like your book is something outside of you. Yeah. And you're gonna care for it. It's yeah. This thing that you cared for every day for years as you wrote it. And the characters, I mean, anyone who reads this book can feel that care with the characters and the place, you know, and the story. So, I mean, it says to me how much of this, this book came out of you and of course you did it, but there's a way that you also are the steward of it and shepherd it, you know, and take care of it. Mm-hmm. So I like that a lot. It's not so much about you and whether you need this external validation that you're a writer or not. And you're right, your mother and other people were right. Like it had nothing to do with your book. It was market forces, publishing at the time, mm-hmm. whatever it is, you know. I mean, we know that there are a lot of problems with traditional publishing and there's articles that come out all the time about how kind of homogeneous it is. And there's a lot of work that needs to happen to have other voices and other books out in the world. And I'm glad that we have this. Okay, so wait, let's talk a little bit about superstition. So what are some other, is today an auspicious day?
Today is a very auspicious day. So after I won, Alon and then my amazing editor, Nathan Rostron and Allison Gore, they all work at Restless Books and Allison was the one to pluck the book out of the submission pile and pass it forward. They wanted to have a video chat with me. And like, I'm just sitting here being like, I won. Like, I don't know what I'm gonna like say in a professional capacity to these people. So the only real question I had for them is, I'm really superstitious. Will you let me pick the day the book comes out? And they said yes. And so literally that was like, I'm like, okay, I'm done. Like, I'm good. So they let me pick the date. And yes, today is a very lucky day. So I'm satisfied, essentially. <Yeah.
laughs> Great. Okay. And yeah, and for me, I can see my mother is here. It's her and my father's wedding anniversary, marriage anniversary.
You mentioned that. Yeah, you totally mentioned that. But yeah, I'm very, very superstitious, Grace. I have an evil eye hanging right there. That was the first thing when I was deciding my Zoom setup. It was like, I need to have an evil eye there. We got to take care of this situation.
Someone is wondering what makes today a lucky day for you.
So on the Hindu lunar calendar, and specifically for anybody who knows specifics and is curious about which one my family uses, we use the one off of the Swaminarayan website. The month is divided up into two 15-day periods. It runs on the cycle of the moons. And every family is going to have dates, numerology that is lucky for them based on like the planets, where the planets were, what houses they were in at the time they were born. And I don't know if this date is specifically lucky for everybody or just for my family, but today is Agyaras. It's 11 or Ekadashi. So that's a very, very lucky date. And our unlucky dates, I don't know, my mom might get mad at me for saying this, are 4 and 9 or 14. I think at one point when I was emailing our mutual editor, Nathan, about dates, and I was like getting ready to explain. So I wrote this long email explaining all of it. And then I was like, I'm not going to do that to him. And I just deleted the whole thing. Like, he does not need an education in this. This is not going to be helpful for him.
In one of the chapters of my memoir, I read about this uncle I had who was a writer, and I visited his wife, and she did numerology on me. And so my lucky date is the 9th of every month. So I'm supposed to like pay attention.
Yeah.
The 9th. And her husband, they believed in numerology so much that he changed the spelling of his name so that he could have another letter in his name and be luckier.
Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have a thing for odd numbers, which is not a familial thing. I think that just might be an Indian Desi thing. Like, if you're going to give a gift of money, it has to end with one. You never give an even number because it can be split. I mean, there's so many things. And my mom in particular is an equal opportunity practitioner of superstition. It doesn't matter what culture it's from, what century it's from, like whatever it is. If she finds out about it, then she'll immediately and seamlessly adopt it into her life. And my whole thing is, I'm actually at my heart quite logical, but if it's easy enough for me to remember to not open an umbrella indoors because that's bad luck, like, why not do it? Because that just increases my chances of having good luck. It's not going to hurt me to do it.
Right.
So why not? Why not do all of these crazy things?
Yeah. In a way, like for me, it's it feels like a way to connect me to my culture. Like there's things that we'll do. Like I can't remember what it is. I think it's like we can't have an odd number or an even number in photographs. I don't remember, but there's a way that like when I'm with my aunties,
right,
they're like, no, get this person out or put this person in because of the number. And so I don't know. It's a way I feel, makes me feel like I belong, I guess, to something.
Yeah. Or almost like, I don't want to say an inside joke, but it's definitely an internal thing that is specific to your culture, that if you meet somebody else of a similar culture, they would immediately get it and know it. It's like a key into that conversation.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to the Immigrant Writing Prize, like that is an experience of being an immigrant in this country, is feeling outside a lot of the time, or always trying to learn, like, what is the dominant culture? What are the norms? And changing myself to that, as opposed to that. I think that's why the other experience is so delightful, because it's sort of rare.
Yeah.
And so I see a few people are posting questions in the Q&A. We're going to definitely get to them, and people can keep posting in there. So for people who haven't gotten the opportunity to read The City of Good Death yet, could you set up the setting for us? I mean, it takes place in a death hostel on the Ganges River in India. And for people who are not familiar with death hostels and these beliefs about death, could you describe the main character, Pramesh, and his role with people at the end of their lives?
Yeah, so this book is set in the city of Benares, which is a real city in India, because I have gotten that question about whether it's real or not. And it's considered to be the holiest city for Hindus, because if you happen to pass away there, you will be forever freed from the cycle of rebirth and reincarnation. That is kind of what Hinduism revolves around. So you achieve the ultimate, you know, nirvana, moksha, salvation, et cetera. You're done. You're never going to have to come back to this place or any other place again. So it's a huge, huge, remarkable thing when you think about it, especially, you know, when you think about the span of possible rebirth that Hinduism talks about, a single person or a single soul could go through millions of lifetimes. So to suddenly have this instant escape or instant way out is not no small thing, essentially. So these establishments called death hostels, which are also very real, the most famous one is called Mukti Bhavan, but there are several others. They're very, very bare bones establishments where somebody can bring their dying family member. You cannot come alone. You have to be accompanied by family members. And that person, usually the time limit that I'm familiar with, it's usually 2 weeks that you have for that person to pass away. And again, very bare bones. So you're not getting meals. This is, you know, you're not getting anything. You're literally usually getting just like a space for you to just camp out. And as soon as that person passes, it's expected that the rites are carried out very, very quickly. And then the family leaves and that's it. You're done. So the main character, Pramesh, is the manager at one of these places. And his job is essentially to, you know, welcome the families who come in, explain the rules to them, kind of acclimate them to the city, because obviously the families still have to go out into the market to buy day-to-day essentials, et cetera, but really also be a party to shepherding that person out on their final days before hopefully they have their exit and they're able to go.
And are there multiple cities like this in India, these sacred cities, or is Benares the most famous?
Benares is the most famous. I mean, you know, definitely there are so many sacred spots in India. I mean, the country is massive in itself. So it's riddled with these types of pilgrimage spots, which are holy for many, many different reasons. But I believe Benares is the only place where this sort of end of guarantee actually exists. And there are reasons for this. One of the reasons I was so interested or got interested in the city was I wanted to know what the logic behind that special capability was. What was the reasoning? Like, obviously it wasn't just somebody thousands of years ago who just decided, okay, this would be a really great place to pass away. This was not the reason. I wanted to know why. And there is a logic behind it. There is a reasoning behind it. I'm not going to get too much into it because, you know, it's complex. It's not just a simple thing. But that in itself is it's a fascinating history to read about.
Yeah. And some of the related questions, I'm sort of scanning the Q&A for related things. And, you know, that does answer one of the questions, which is about the title. So there is like, this is the place that is the city of good death.
Yeah.
And that is that something that people call it, or is that a title that you made up?
So I'm not aware of the city actually being called the city of good death. Funnily enough, it has been called the city of light, which I know a lot of people associate with Paris rather than with Benares, but it has been called that. And there is a fantastic book, an ethnography by Diana L. Eck that I consulted, which was published in the 80s called Benares City of Light. So I'm sorry, Grace, what was the question? My brain just blipped.
No, it's okay. It was just about the title. Like, city.
Yes, the title. But it is when somebody is able to die a death there, it is noted as a good death. You know, a good death being the fact that you are not going to come back, the best possible death one can ask for. But one of the questions I was really interested in is just that definition of a good death. And is it as simple as just passing away in that city? Or does it have a lot to do with, is it more about the person who is dying, or is it about the people who have been left behind?
Yeah. And, you know, the book opens with you know, besides the preface and other sorts of earlier material, the first chapter does open with a death, with the open, you know, a body that's found in the river. So we start there, and then that question of how did that person die, and who is the person, how did they die, was that a good death? I mean, that is a question that's explored throughout the book. Have you been able to visit Benares?
Yeah, so spoiler alert, I have never been to Benares. I still have not been able to visit it. That's something that caused me a great amount of unease before I decided to write this book. And it still causes me some unease and some guilt. You know, I feel like there's still that question drumming in the back of my mind, which is, what gives you the right to tell this story? It's a very, very layered question. You know, I have been to India several times, but only ever as a tourist. I have not been to that city specifically. I have lived a life within the Hindu philosophy my entire life, so I have that knowledge. And I have an intensely visual memory, so I remember almost everything from what I saw that was interesting to me during my travels to India. But there are a lot of tick marks against me. You know, the fact of never having physically visited the city is a huge one in my mind. I cannot claim Banaras even in my familiar heritage because my parents are not Banarasi. They are from the state of Gujarat, which is a totally different state. And so I am Gujarati by dint of that. And then I have an added obstacle of being born and raised in the United States and being educated entirely within that United States Western education system, which we all know is very, very narrow and at times highly flawed, even with its own history. So that there was a lot. There was a lot of that. And again, I still feel unease about it. In the end, the way I justified it, and I guess the way I continue to justify it, is that I don't think I had a choice about writing or not. I think that story just decided it was going to plant itself with me. And so I had to decide whether I was going to do something about it or not. In all of the research that I did, and I mentioned, I started reading up about Banaras because I was very, very curious. I just wanted to know the reason why, like what is the logic and that underpinning behind why this city does what everybody says it does. And there is something to be said for it. It's apparently the oldest living city on Earth, which is a really big deal. What does that make it, like thousands of years old of being continually occupied? I just wanted to know. And so as I started reading, the more and more I started reading, the deeper in I fell because it was just so interesting to me. And I also started looking beyond reading into like books of photography, into more ethnography, into documentary, other films. YouTube is fantastic because you have tourists who have been to Banaras who are literally just holding up their iPhone, walking through these really narrow, cramped lanes, and they're not saying anything, but you can hear all that ambient sound like along with that video. So it gives you this magnificent trompe-l'oeil effect of being, you're the one walking, not this person holding the camera, you're the one having that feeling. As I was doing all of that, taking my notes, not really know where I was going with any of it, I just started hearing bits of dialogue. I just started seeing bits of scene. I just started writing other things down. And I don't know where they were coming from, but they were populating from somewhere. And eventually it got to a frequency and a volume where I realized this is essentially a very slowly moving train going past me. And I'm on the platform. And I can decide, am I going to jump on and see what happens? Or am I just going to stay where I'm at? And I decided to jump on. And it led me all the way over here.
I think that's I love that image of describing your creative process because, you know, there's so many ways that we can refuse a creative project of some sort and you know, it's much harder to say yes to it. There's so many reasons to say no. It takes time. It, you know, am I ready? Like, what right do I have? But there was, you know, it found you and then you decided to that you were going to take it on and you don't do it in an entitled way that like, oh, like you have the right to tell this story and you're, but you came at it, of course you do, but you came at it in a way that was humble and you learned and you looked on YouTube and yeah, like there's incredible stuff on YouTube. Like I watched a person take a 3-hour walk in Manila. I don't even know what that, like, it was just on and it was 3 hours. And I did watch it, but I don't know, like there's all kinds of material that you can use and be to feed that creativity. But it does, you know, bring up questions about what fiction writers do and what is possible for us as artists. Because I do know that, you know, we've probably felt this growing up in this country and reading books that have stereotypical, really offensive, if they even had depictions of Chinese characters or other people in books and movies, they're usually, they were destructive. So yeah, I mean, it does bring up these questions, but I also think that you approached it in like the most responsible way that feeds your creativity. And you knew enough that you could get to the point where you start to see and hear dialogue and scenes because you've fed that or you've filled the well, is another way to say it. It's like, you know, you have this male character. I mean, Pramesh is doing this work, and, you know, even just in some ways, this is a novel about occupation and about someone's work. Like, we're in this hostel, and we see the day-to-day life that happens there, and you know, it's so immersive. And, you know, he's that person. You know, you don't have that experience, but, like, I mean, is the person who does have that experience, I mean, you know, are they going to write this book, like, too? So they, you know, so I don't know, it makes me think about, like, what we can do as artists and writers.
I wonder about that all the time. And I've talked about it with my writing group as well, in terms of, what do we owe when you're writing fiction? What do you owe reality? And when are you allowed to just make it all up and make whatever you want to have happen? And I don't know, because I think buried in that question are really, really important, an entirely different conversation, which is about appropriation and the fact that there is an unequal distribution in terms of the books that we see from the diversity of voices that exist. If this was an egalitarian society in its entirety and everything was absolutely, it was published simply based on merit and value, then maybe we could get to a point where anybody could write about everything, anything and everything that they wanted to. But because we're not at that point, I think, you know, it is important to ask that question. And I'm not going to be able to answer that question ever for myself. I'm fully expecting somebody at one point to just come up to me and be like, you got everything wrong. And I'm highly offended. And all I'll be able to say is, you know, I'm really, really sorry. Like, I totally understand. And just hope that we can both move on with our lives. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does take that courage to say, you know, I might get things wrong. I probably will, because none of us are perfect, and I'm going to still try. I'm going to still do it. Like, my conviction about what I'm doing and what I want to make is strong enough that, you know, I'm going to do it anyways.
Before I forget, Grace, you have to send me this 3-hour video walking in Manila, because I want to walk in Manila too. So
I will.
There's I've never been and I'd love to go. So.
But what came to mind for me, I'm like, first of all, why did this person do it? And why did thousands of people like me watch it? And I think it's homesickness, because you can put it on in the background and someone is walking around for 3 hours. And, you know, Filipinos work, the diaspora, we work all over the world. And this is a way that you can, like, see your country. I think I want to move to some of the questions, because there's great questions and I wanted to make sure we get to them. And some of them are related to each other. So I'm going to sort of put those together. So there's questions about work. And Amelia is asking, you know, what is the full-time job that you worked while writing the book? Do you think it was stressful because you were working? And then someone else has sort of a related question about, you know, if you're working on a computer for your day job, then, you know, how hard is it to come home and then also work on the computer to write your book?
Yeah. I got to be careful about this one, because I think some people from my job are watching, so I can't say anything too off the mark.
Okay.
I'm totally kidding. So I still work full time. I have always worked a full time job. When I was in school, I was working part time. And then when I haven't been in school, I've always ever, you know, working night and day for the man in the city. Now, so I mean, it's interesting. I'm wondering how much I should say about this, Grace, because one of the reasons this is interrelated, one of the reasons I have forced writing to work within my life is I have intensely compartmentalized things. So I made a decision once I finished graduate school, and I started working full time almost immediately afterward, just a couple of weeks afterward. I decided I was not going to tell anybody that I was working on anything ever. I decided that was something that belonged to me and to me alone, and it was precious, and I just wasn't going to share it So I had some people, you know, occasionally some people might ask about it because they knew that I had received an MFA in creative writing. So they wanted to know what I was working on. And I'm always very, very aloof and very, very surface level purposely. I really like to keep that separation there. So because of that separation, I wonder if I should also probably not say too much about my job because I'm supposed to be writer Priyanka right now and not whatever it is I do in my real day adult life. But I do, I work at George Mason University and I have worked there for almost 20 years, believe it or not. And I have amazing coworkers and colleagues. So I will say that about them because they are listening and will likely report me to my boss at some point, somewhere, sometime. So, but in terms of fitting writing within the day-to-day life and also working all day on a computer at work and then, you know, coming home and firing up the laptop again, there are different ways I deal with it. I write a lot longhand. One of the things I always do, no matter what job I have worked, is I always take my full lunch hour, like whatever lunch break that they offer, and I get away from my desk and I do something writing related. I wrote a lot of this book during lunch breaks, to be honest. I found that probably like a mild form of that phenomenon I've heard a lot of new mothers talk about, where if they're also artists and if they have like a babysitter for 2 hours, they can't dilly-dally like once their 2 hours start. They got to get going and get that work going because they know they only have that 2 hours before like the clock stops and they have to go back. And so I definitely had that same feeling. Like, I know I only have 45 minutes or an hour or whatever it is. I need, like, my brain needs to just get going immediately. And this is the amount of time that I have. I would also do other work that I consider to be writing work. So that means reading, taking a walk, listening to a podcast, like anything that just frees your brain from, detaches it from what you've been doing in your job and gives you a pocket of space and time where you can be the artist. And then you go back to your job and then you detach again. I do a lot of writing longhand. So that's one thing I already said. I don't know that I ever had too much of a problem of working all day on a computer and then coming home and firing up my laptop. You know, they're two different machines. The difference in geographic place makes a huge difference, I think. The fact that, like, well, anyway, I used to have an office to go to. I've been working remotely since the pandemic, but having that difference of physical space is really helpful. It's difficult now because now the desk that I do my day job at is also the desk that I've kind of done sun writing. I don't know how much writing I've done, but it's the same thing. But I have two different machines. Like, I have a work machine and then I have like my own personal machine. So even having that is a difference. You just need something to separate the two. So it doesn't feel like when you open up a notebook or you open up a laptop, your brain needs to know that you're going to start being your writing self. You're not going to be that other self that you have to be by necessity.
I love that. It's like showing, I guess, a respect for the work and like for yourself, you know, and if it helps you to have those kinds of boundaries and distinctions, knowing yourself and saying, well, that's what works for me. So that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways that I've read about writers cueing themselves. Like, there's famous stories of like someone, maybe it's E.L. Doctorow, like dressing in a suit, I think, and going downstairs to the basement to write.
I think that might have been Cheever, because I've heard that story. Yeah.
There's all these, yeah. But there's all these ways that, you know, it's very rare that people would get the life conditions where you don't have anything else to do. Even if you've published a bunch of books, people need some other income or some other part of, you know, they have other responsibilities too. So, you know, you say compartmentalize. I also think about privacy, like making a space in your life for your art and your creative work that is private. And it doesn't matter, like, if an editor or a publisher wants it, it's like your space to do this thing makes you feel alive.
Other thing, Grace, I have found is not a lot of people get it. Unless you're engaged in some sort of creative process, a lot of people don't get it. They just assume it's some sort of hobby or some sort of way to pass time. And I found that out really, really early on. And felt quite hurt when I would get some sort of reaction that was dismissive, when I felt I had revealed something that was intensely personal and intensely precious to me, and I would get a very, very dismissive or jokey kind of response. And I realized, well, you don't have to tell anybody anything. You know, I don't have to justify myself to anybody anywhere at any time, except for my mom. But you know, like you have a choice about that. And as the years go by, I am intensely protective of that choice. I didn't tell anybody about this book. I didn't show it to my writing group of, I don't know, I had been meeting with them 6 or 7 years by then. They didn't see any part of the book until I had a full, complete draft to give them. And I didn't talk about it with anybody either. I didn't, even with my family, with friends, there were 0 people that I discussed it with. But that's what worked for me. And it made it mine. It gave me the freedom to fail when I needed to fail and be private in my failure and figure out on my own, how do I get up and move forward without consulting anybody else. And then any joy that I got out of it too, that was mine completely. I did not have to share it with anybody. So I don't see myself changing anytime soon in that respect. It's what works for me. And I think it's really important for people to have something in their life. It doesn't have to be writing. It could be anything, but just one thing that is just yours and nobody else's.
I think that's so great. And I just imagine, you know, how much joy and pleasure it could, you know, it gave you over the years to have that space to do your project and to do the thing that was yours. And you didn't have to answer to anybody about, oh, how many words did you do today? Or, you know, nothing. It's like, it's your thing. And, you know, I think we share so much. Like there's all these ways that, like, you know, post this and that, and it's wonderful to have something that's yours. You know, people are asking like incredible questions here. It's like, it's really robust. So I'm trying to look. So over time, did the idea for your book change?
Oh, yes, I would say it did. Not over a long range of time, though. I think it changed in that initial stage. I started writing it in my final year of graduate school, and I was very, very lucky. I was given a fellowship for my final year, which meant I didn't have to teach, and I was almost done with classes by then. I basically had a fully funded year to do nothing but work on this book. And I'd spent the preceding summer finishing up all my research. And I had an outline for what this book was going to be. And it was going to be an amazing book. I could already tell. And then I sat down to start writing it. It didn't want to be that book. It didn't want to come to me. I kept knock, knock, knocking on that door. Nothing was happening. Everything sounded stupid. It just sounded false and fraudulent. It was just a huge hot mess. And I was getting really, really anxious and stressed out because I'm so lucky. I'm the person in my graduate program who got this fully funded year. I'm never going to have this chance in my life again. I knew I was going to start working again as soon as I graduated. So I was just so stressed out, which we both know is like the secret to lock you down even further. Like, it's just never going to come if that's the way you are. I ended up picking up Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie. And that had been sitting on my shelf for years, and I would pick it up and start reading it and never felt like it was the right time in my life to read it. So I would put it back down, and I picked it up then, and it was the right time in my life. And I read it, and it was instant jolt of adrenaline. He is having so much fun when he wrote that book. The fun is just oozing out of the pages, like his joy, his unmitigated glee. And it was the best reminder to me to be like, hey, idiot, you need to be having fun while you're doing this. Like, it's not this, like, you're not all like profound all the time. You need to be having fun. You need to bring joy into the work. You need to enjoy it, because if it's painful every day, then you're not going to be able to make anything. So a couple of weeks later, I was in my public library with my laptop staring at the blank screen, and an image just popped into my head. And it had nothing to do with this fantastic outline that I had made for myself, but nothing else was happening. So okay, let me just go ahead and write this down. And then it just started building and building and building. And that image was of those two boatmen who are out on the water in the very beginning of the book, taking a secret drink from their wives. And it was fun, Grace. It was so much fun. I wanted to see who these two dudes were. I wanted to see who this body was. I wanted to see how that body got there, how it died, how it was connected to the people in the city. I wanted to hear all of the gossip racing through the streets. I just wanted to be there. And I found my entry point into the book. The best part of this story is I got to meet Salman Rushdie maybe a year later. I think he was promoting Luca and the Fire of Life. So I got to see him at Sixth and I Synagogue in DC. And I got there super early so I could get a number for the book signing line. And I was number 15. And I got to tell him what that book meant to me. And he was so kind. And he asked me what I was writing about. And I wouldn't tell him because I don't tell anybody what I'm working on ever. But he was so gracious and kind. And he treated me like a real writer, even though at that point I was a graduate student who hadn't ever published anything and who wouldn't publish anything for another 10 years.
Yeah. You know, this, some of my students are here tonight and I tell them, I try to say this all the time about like writing as an act of discovery. Even if you're writing memoir and you're writing about your life, which you already lived, you know, it's going to be interesting to you and the reader if you are discovering as a narrator on the page, like what's happening. And so this, you know, your story of like coming across these two people, these two men who are, you know, in the boat, and then you want to find out what's going to happen to them. Like that's the experience of the reader. Like we start there and I'm like, oh yeah, who are these people? And what is this body? And who was he? And, you know, and that's the same kind of like momentum that takes me through. So it's neat to think about like your experience as a writer also transmitting to the reader as well.
That's the hope. I definitely hope that they have the same experience of wanting to turn the page because you want to find out what happens next, because that's why I was writing. I wanted to know what happens next. I mean, sorry, yeah. I wasn't really thinking about you guys. I was thinking about me.
Yeah. Right. And also like, I think being able to like pivot away from an outline and an idea that maybe you spent a lot of time on, but isn't going anywhere. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's fine that you put all that preparation and maybe doing that preparation work to help you get to that spot where you're sitting in the library. It's not an efficient process. You know, I think what matters is that you show up for yourself at least and try that. We're not gonna get to all of the questions, but I'm gonna try some of them. So one related question is, did you send Salman Rushdie a copy of the book?
Oh gosh, I don't know if we did or not. Yeah, he might've been on the list, okay. But I don't know if we did or not. So yeah, if you gentle person who asked, if you have a way of getting him the book, we'd love to connect with you. I'd love to get him the book. But yeah, I don't think we did. I mean, come on, it's Salman Rushdie. He gets like a bajillion books every day. You know, he can only read so much. And really the gift was that interaction with him because he didn't have to do that. And you and I both, Grace, have probably met enough Pulitzer Prize winners, Nobel Prize winners, et cetera, who have not been kind and who have not offered that. So, you know, it was a gift for me and it's a moment that I'm so appreciative for.
Yeah. So what about the female characters in the book? Someone is asking about the protagonist's wife who supports his aspirations and his complex relationship with his job.
Yeah, Shoba is interesting because she was so easy to write. And I guess I was surprised at how easy she was to write. And I guess off the bat, that might be an absurd thing to say because, you know, she's a woman, I'm a woman. I don't know. Those are the commonalities that the two of us had. But she was interesting to me because she has her own journey to go on. And she, of course, being a woman in this particular kind of society is limited to her own box. She does not have the same freedoms that a man does. And I've been asked in a few interviews to just speak to that difference in gender and how that perhaps results in I don't know, you know, saying whatever it does about that type of society or those types of rules. And what I came up with is none of this was intentional when I was writing it. I wasn't thinking about this in any sort of direct way. But in thinking about it, what I've come up with is in any sort of society that oppresses based on class, gender, sexuality, religion, personhood, you know, pick your oppression of choice. People within that box are always going to figure out a way to get what they want if they really, really want it. And they're going to be incredible. They're going to employ incredible ingenuity in order to get what they want. So what's interesting to me is how that plays out. What do they end up doing? How do they end up kind of maneuvering around to get there? Where do they trip up and where do they get into trouble? And how does that inform what they do moving forward? And of course, there's also real tragedy in that too, because imagine if they didn't have any barriers at all. Like, what wonders could they accomplish if they were totally free? And then also look at the opposite. When you look at whatever group is in power, well, are they doing everything they could be doing with that power that they have? Those are just things that I've noticed after the fact. Again, I mean, I wasn't doing this in any sort of direct way when I was actually writing. It was really just, it wasn't thinking Shoba is a woman, so this is what she's going to do next. It was thinking, well, Shoba is Shoba, so this is what she's going to do next.
Yeah. Yeah. And trusting your vision or the images or, you know, the story that came to mind, and then, you know, maybe figuring out some of that other stuff later, but yeah, trusting Shoba. To be Shoba. We probably just have like a minute or two left. Someone has a question about the audiobook. Do you have an audiobook?
There's an audiobook, Grace. I know. Yeah, no, Restless Books really surprised me. Nathan especially definitely surprised me. And I got to, this is like, I live a very intentionally boring life, you guys. A lot of you who know me know that already. So this was so super glamorous. They sent me this ginormous list of all these like voice actors. And I spent like, I don't know how long, a week agonizing over who to pick. And we ended up picking this fantastic voice actor. He did an amazing job. I've only listened to a clip of it, but I haven't heard the whole thing, but what he did do, I sampled in my car while I was driving, and I almost got in an accident. And there was like nobody on the road either. So that tells you that.
Yeah. Amazing. My mother. Oh. My mother has a question. So
Oh yes, we have to answer your mom's question.
She says, are these death hostels comparable to hospice here? How do family members know that the person is dying and, you know, enough to bring them to the death hostel?
So it's not comparable to hospice. I'm not too familiar with the inner workings of hospice, although I know the ins and outs of it, but there's no like 24/7 nursing care that's offered at all. It's literally your family members bring you, and they are responsible for all of your needs, all of your wants, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not comparable in that sense at all.
Yeah. All right. I think we are going to get to the last question, which is, do lucky days figure in the book? Oh, yeah. And the other thing. Yeah. Okay. Do lucky days figure in the book at all?
No, they don't, because again, they're intensely familial. So any days that are personal to my family, wouldn't figure in the book.
Okay. And do you, like, what are you reading these days? Like, what would you recommend?
I'm so glad you asked, Grace. So this, you're fulfilling all of my LeVar Burton reading rainbow dreams right now. We just need the audience to bring in the theme song and my life will be complete. But I bought this from Greenlight Bookstore. They were amazing and they shipped it to me super quick. This is called Duck, Death, and the Tulip by Wolf Earlbrook, and it's published by Gecko Press. I think Katie is gonna, she just put the link up. So definitely check it out and buy it from Greenlight if you can. It's a beautiful children's picture book about a duck who's just going about her daily life. And then one day death shows up and wants to hang out. And Duck is very skeptical at first, but then she soon sees death as a companion and a friend. It's a beautiful book. It might seem like it's really morbid, but I really think it's for all ages because it's also intensely complex and profound. And my mom read it as well. We both read it a couple of weeks ago when it arrived, and we're both still talking about it, particularly about the meaning of the tulip. So if anybody reads it and has ideas and wants to pass them on, I would love to hear. But yeah, definitely check this book out. It's beautiful. And buy it from Greenlight. Support Greenlight.
Well, okay, there's a last quick question. Do you know Lawrence Cohen's book on Benares?
I don't think I do.
There's some titles in the back in your notes of text that you have, mm-hmm. Reference and stuff. Well, congratulations, Priyanka. So happy for you. And it's such a beautiful book. It's so amazing. I've like have all these sticky notes all over the place, all these lines that will stay with me and that I'll think about. And I want to thank Greenlight Books and Restless Books, of course. And please buy Priyanka's book from Greenlight and support a wonderful indie bookstore.
Grace, thank you so much for this. It's always lovely to see you. Thank you, Katie with Greenlight. And I have to say, this whole event, you all are in danger of reviving my cold, dead, shriveled heart from the pandemic. What is the sensation I feel on my chest? Oh, it's my heart beating. Thank you.
Grace and Priyanka, thank you so much for that fantastic discussion. And thanks to everybody for joining us. If you missed any of tonight's event, or if you just want to watch it again, we will be posting this to our YouTube channel. So please look out for it there. And don't forget to buy your copy of The City of Good Death in-store or online at greenlightbookstore.com. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Greenlight Bookstore podcast. We're grateful to our production partners at Libro FM for working with us to produce the quarantine season. Libro FM provides access to thousands of digital audiobooks through partnerships with independent bookstores nationwide. You can purchase Libro FM audiobooks at greenlightbookstore.com. You can subscribe to the Greenlight Bookstore podcast on iTunes, download it as a free audiobook from Libro FM, or stream it on greenlightbookstore.com/podcast. On the Greenlight website, you can also find links to purchase the books discussed in this episode and many more, as well as information about Greenlight's store locations and shopping hours. The best way to support your local independent bookstore and the literary communities we serve is as simple as buying a book.